I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Today, we present a special broadcast of California Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State Address. He'll be delivering that live in just a few moments. We'll air the full speech at the top of the program and then return to take your calls and emails for the remainder of the hour. We'll also be joined by Dan Walters. He's a political columnist with the Sacramento Bee, and he has been following the governor since his first term. Jerry Brown is expected to call for a decrease in state spending and an increase in tax rates to fill in the gap in California's $9.2 billion budget deficit. Specifically, Brown is making a strong push for California voters this November to approve a temporary increase in sales and income taxes to prevent further deep cuts to state programs, including education. The income tax ballot measure, if passed, would create three new tax brackets and raise $35 billion in income. Single taxpayers would pay an additional 1 percentage point on earnings over $250,000, 1.5 percentage points on income over $300,000, and 2 percentage points on earnings over $500,000. These rates would be in effect from 2013 until 2016. And even if these tax increases pass, cuts across the state will still be broad and deep. That's even if Brown's tax proposal is passed by voters. In Brown's current budget proposal, $1 billion would be cut from CalWORKs, which is one of the state's welfare programs, welfare-to-work programs, and a little over $1 billion would be cut from the Department of Corrections. Nearly $80 million would be slashed from K-12 schools, $842 million from Medi-Cal, and 70 state parks would face closure. Brown might also address the California Supreme Court's decision, which allows the state to abolish redevelopment agencies in order to redirect about $1.8 billion back to the state budget. That would happen on February 1st, just a few weeks from now. In contrast, Brown is also expected to make the case for continued support of California's high-speed rail. That is the bullet train that is estimated to cost nearly $100 billion and has been the subject of a lot of controversy recently. So we're wondering, what do you make of these cuts? What do you think of the tax proposal? What do you think Governor Brown should prioritize? And what's your reaction to his upcoming speech, which we're going to hear in just a few moments? What do you prescribe for California in 2012? We're going to listen to the State of the State address as soon as it starts. But in the meantime, we've got Dan Walters on the line. Hi, Dan. Do we have Dan?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi. Sorry, couldn't hear you there for a minute. So before we hear the speech, and just know that I might interrupt you at any moment if he does start the speech, can you give us a little bit of a sense of the roots of this crisis? Why is California in a chronic budget crisis?
Because we spend more than we take in.
Yeah, go ahead. Give me more. Thank you. Thank you.
I know that's
budget 101.
But I mean, in reality, that's true. Over time, we, both as voters and through the people we elect the legislature, have committed the state to spending more than the revenue system can produce, even when the economy is doing well.
How much of this is Prop 13, do you think?
Well, you know, that was 34 years ago, and yes, it contributes to the state's financial dilemma, fiscal dilemma, but it's not really the only cause. In fact, you know, the truth of it is that property taxes in California have gone up faster than state revenues during that 34-year period. So it's hard to blame it on Proposition 13, although many people try. If you actually look and go through the kind of the autopsy of California's fiscal problems, it's a factor perhaps, but it's also more that the state took on after Proposition 13, took on more burden than its revenue system would produce. Remember, one of the two responses of the legislature after Proposition 13 passed in 1978, within a matter of a few weeks, they both did what's called the bailout of schools and local governments. In other words, pumping a lot of state money into schools and local governments. And simultaneously, and the governor likes to forget this part of it, enacted a very large state income tax cut because they wanted to get straight with the voters who had just passed Proposition 13. The effect of those two actions was to throw the state budget into an immediate deficit. And it's more or less been there ever since to one degree or another. So when I say literally, they spend more than they take in, that's literally true. There's also been a lot of changes in the taxation system since then. Some of the changes in the system itself and some of the changes in by changes in the economy and the whole structure of public finance in California, state and local, has undergone a lot of change in the last 34 years and fundamentally not for the better. You have to keep in mind that California has the fifth largest state and local tax burden in the country as a percentage of personal income, the fifth largest. So it's not that we're so terribly undertaxed. Maybe we just have spent too much money. We spend twice as much money on prisons as we should be spending, probably, for example.
Brown is calling for a really big slashing of the prison budget, which is, hasn't been done by anybody else.
Well, yes, he is, but not only because they're shifting inmates down into the hands of local governments and sending them the sales taxes to pay for them. So it's the actual cut in spending, if you put those two things together, is not nearly as dramatic as he would have you believe. It's actually staying about the same.
That's a surprise. So it sounded like a really big cut, and it sounded like the prison union lobby usually it doesn't allow for that.
Well, what they're doing is they're simply shifting inmates into the hands of county jails.
But he's also talking about stopping new construction of prisons
because they're going into county jails. Yes, but the money flowed with the prisoners. The state is still paying for those prisoners. They're not paying them through the state prison system, they're paying them through local county jails. I mean, tens of thousands already just since last year. I mean, so you have to look at this thing in total. You can't just take one slice of it and say, this is the problem or this is the solution to the problem. You have to look at the totality of state and local government, the totality of what they spend, the totality of the taxes they levy, and how they spend that money to get an accurate picture. Perhaps we are underfunded, but just pick one little thing and say that's true. Doesn't really cut it. And by the way, the governor's just walking up to the podium right now.
I was just about to tell you that. That's Dan Walters. He's joining us for the remainder of the hour when we'll be taking your calls. We're waiting for Brown to head to the podium and start his State of the State address. In the meantime, Dan, what is your assessment of Brown's proposal that he's going to take to the voters in November on new taxes?
He has what I would call a fair to middling chance of winning it. Fair to middling. That's actually a cotton grading term, by the way. It really is. It's a cotton grade, fair to middling.
Thank you.
But it means that he's got a chance, 50-50, maybe 40-60, something like that. But remember, you're asking voters of California to tax themselves more in the midst of what they consider to be the worst recession in their memory. That's going to be a tough sell. Particularly, you have these anecdotal things of the legislature handing out raises, the DREAM Act, all these things that, to many people, waste money. It makes it a harder sell down the line.
And California's economy seems to be recovering somewhat. Some people are saying that that will also make the tax increases a harder sell. What do you think?
Well, I think it may make it a little easier sell. People feel better about themselves. They're generally more willing to raise taxes. But it's going to be a hard sell. Taxes are always a hard sell in this state. You know, we have the reputation of being this blue state, but when it comes to taxes, we're not particularly a blue state. The last time they put taxes on the ballot in 2009, they got killed. And so this is a real chancy sort of thing. One of the reasons this deal didn't come together last year is that the polls looked very negative for the idea of these tax extensions. And the governor wanted to try it, but his allies were a little not too happy about it because they thought it might be a loser. So this is a dicey thing. He's kind of rolling the dice on this thing.
And how what's your assessment of Governor Jerry Brown in the 70s versus Governor Jerry Brown today?
In many ways, he has not changed a bit. In many ways, he's matured. I think he's more attentive to duty. He's not off running for president every other day the way he was then. You know, literally, it was a nonstop campaign for his first 8 years. He was always running for something, either re-election, president twice, U.S. Senate. It was five campaigns in 8 years after he became governor. And so you have to put this in kind of it's a different age. He's older. He's more focused on the job of governing. But his fundamental personality, his fundamental approach to things is very, very similar, I think. It really hasn't changed all that much.
What do you think were the highlights of his first governorship?
Well, I think it's hard to say because he was so focused on his campaigns. You could pick out certain things. He tried to get a water program and basically in the end failed. He did a farm labor bill. He got that through. He was considered in many ways a visionary. He had a kind of a thing of the moment. One day it was space travel. The next day it was saving the whales. The next day it was something else. And it was all geared to whatever he was running, what office he was running for at the time. So it's very difficult to judge his governorship in a vacuum because it was always in this context of the next campaign, whatever that might be. But this is a different thing. This time he's actually trying to govern, and that puts it in a different mode.
And one of the most controversial plans of Governor Jerry Brown is to abolish the redevelopment agencies and put that money back into the state budget. What's your assessment of that, which may take effect very soon?
That's a done deal. I mean, it's done. And then those agencies are supposed to shut down by February the 1st. There are efforts, as I mentioned in my column this morning, there are efforts underway to try to resuscitate them. They have a faint pulse, and some people are trying to revive them. And there's a little remorse in some in the legislature. Oh, we did this, and maybe we shouldn't have done it, or maybe we need to do it, we bring it back or something. But Jerry doesn't seem to be very interested in bringing it back. He seemed to be, let's let it go and then think about it later, but let it settle out first before you start trying to undo what you did last year.
Which is really interesting because as mayor of Oakland, he used redevelopment dollars to do many of the signature programs of his mayoral tenure.
Welcome to Brown's world. It's one day one thing, another day another thing. It's always been, that's what I say, he hasn't really changed very much, has he? Because he was well known for doing a 180-degree turn in a nanosecond, and he still has that capacity. He's the guy who says that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. That's the way he quotes somebody else. It wasn't his original quote, but he's fond of that. So he's the guy who changes his mind, changes direction very quickly, and that much hasn't changed at all.
And we're waiting for Jerry Brown to start his State of the State address. We'll be taking your calls after that, and we'll be talking with Dan Walters. He's a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee and has been following politics in California for decades. And so you talked about how what the chances of getting this tax proposal passed from the voters in November, but what do you think of the substance of the proposal, which would increase taxes for the very wealthy in California?
It's a poll-tested approach. The polls indicate that voters are, first of all, willing to raise taxes on the rich because they're not paying them, and secondly, they seem to like sales taxes better than other forms of taxation. So this is a poll-tested tax program. It's not what's the best kind of approach we can do to fixing the finances of California. This is what can we do to get past the voters? I think it has, in substance, has a lot of danger to it. It would increase our reliance on how well a handful of wealthy people are doing in the stock market. And that creates more volatility, and that's one of the big problems with the California budget is this volatility. Their revenues go up and down like a yo-yo, but the spending side of the ledger gets fixed in. And that's why you have these boom and bust sort of cycles in California, and it's a very, very insidious trend. And his proposal would increase that considerably. It would make us dependent on income taxes for over 60% of the state's revenues. When he was governor the first time, it was 30%. So this is one of the things I said. There's many things that have changed over the last 34 years. That's one of the things that have changed. And that makes the budgetary problem of California infinitely worse when you're dependent on how well a couple of 100,000 people are doing in the stock market and trying to predict how they're going to do in the stock market a year or 18 months in advance. And that's this volatility factor that has been, it's corrosive. It just corrodes the entire budget process, makes it a crapshoot rather than some sort of rational financial planning vehicle.
And, you know, one of the places where cuts are going to happen is to education in California, and public education has been taking a lot of hits in recent years. What is the substance of those budget cuts? How is that going to affect schools?
Well, it's going to affect them a lot, but the governor is proposing to, as you know, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, right? Who said that? Emmanuel Rahm, right, in the White House.
Hey, Dan, we'll go back to education in just a moment. Okay. We're going to go listen to Governor Brown now.
Right.
He's being introduced by Lieutenant Governor.
Fellow dignitaries and fellow citizens, as required by the state constitution, I'm reporting to you this morning on the condition of our state. Before I do, I just want to make one notation. I noticed that Connie and Mr. Huff put out their critique of my speech 24 hours ago. Now, I'll let you in a little secret. My speech wasn't finished 24 hours ago. And I do want to say, I didn't know that you were psychics and that you possessed the powers of precognition and clairvoyance. After the speech, I want to check with you on some stock tips. We could use them, especially in the state. Look, putting it as simply as I can, California is on the mend. Last year, we were looking at a structural deficit of $20 billion. It was a real mess. But you rose to the occasion, and together, we shrunk state government, reduced our borrowing costs, and transferred key functions to local government closer to the people. The result is a problem one-fourth of what we confronted last year. My goal then was to balance budget cuts with a temporary extension of existing taxes if the voters approve. You made the reductions and some very difficult decisions, but the four Republican votes needed to put the tax measure on the ballot were not there. So we're left with unfinished business, closing the remaining gap. Again, I propose cuts and temporary taxes. Neither is popular, but both must be done. In a world still reeling from the collapse of the financial system, it makes no sense to spend more than we have. The financial downgrading of the United States, as well as of several governments in Europe, should be warning enough. It is said that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and digging ourselves into a deep financial hole to do good is a bad idea. In this time of uncertainty, prudence and paying down debt is the best policy. For my part, I'm determined to press ahead with substantial budget cuts and my tax initiative. The cuts are not ones I like, but the situation demands them. As for the initiative, it's fair, it's temporary, and it's half of what people were paying in 2010. And it will protect our schools and guarantee in the Constitution funding for the public safety programs we transferred to local government. With enough time, we can and should devise more permanent tax reform. But for now, we should finish the job of bringing spending into line with revenues. Putting our fiscal house in order is good stewardship, and it helps regain the trust of the people. It also builds confidence in California as a place to invest and to realize one's dreams. Contrary to those critics who fantasize that California is a failed state, I see unspent potential and incredible opportunity. Every decade since the 60s, dystopian journalists write stories on the impending decline of our economy, our culture, and our politics. Yes, it's fair to say that California is turbulent, less predictable, and, well, different. Yet, look at the facts. After the mortgage bubble burst in 2007, California lost 1 million jobs, much of it driven by the over-leveraged construction industry and its financial partners in the under-regulated mortgage industry. The result is a recovery far slower than after the previous six national recessions. But now we're coming back. In 2011, California personal income grew by almost $100 billion and 230,000 jobs were created, a rate much higher than the nation as a whole. Contrary to those declinists who sing of Texas and bemoan our woes, California is still the land of dreams as well as the Dream Act. And thank you for sending me that. California is the place where Apple, Intel, Hewlett-Packard, Oracle, Qualcomm, Twitter, Facebook, and countless other creative companies all began. It's home to more Nobel laureates and venture capital investment than any other state. In 2010, California received 48% of U.S. venture capital investments, and in the first months, 3 months of last year, it rose even higher to 52%. There is more than four times, that is more than four times greater than the next recipient, Massachusetts. As for new patents, California inventors were awarded almost four times as many as inventors from the next state, New York. California has problems, but rumors of its demise are greatly exaggerated. The year 212 presents plenty of opportunity, and if we work together, we can stimulate jobs, build renewable energy, reduce pollution and greenhouse gases, launch the nation's only high-speed rail system, reach agreement on a plan to fix the Delta, improve our schools, reform our pensions, and make sure that prison realignment is working to protect public safety and reduce recidivism. Last year, I appointed a top advisor with an impressive record in the private sector and charged him with finding out what doesn't work for businesses in the state and how to fix it. What he heard consistently was that business needed an effective champion to navigate the state's plethora of complex laws and regulations, which can discourage investment and job creation. You enacted a law to restructure our Office of Business Development and place it in the governor's office. Under the name GoBiz, we now have a point of contact at the highest level for businesses large and small. More than that, the GoBiz office is staffed with people who understand what it's like to be in business, and they stand ready to intervene and give real help to get businesses open and projects off the ground. Already, California is leading the nation in creating jobs in renewable energy and the design and construction of more efficient buildings and new technologies. Our state keeps demanding more efficient structures, cars, machines, and electric devices. We do that because we understand that fossil fuels, particularly foreign oil, creates ever-rising costs to our economy and to our health. It's true that the renewable energy sector is small relative to the overall economy, but it pays good wages and will only grow bigger as oil prices increase and the effects of climate change become more obvious and expensive. I've set a goal of 20,000 megawatts of renewable energy by 2020. You've laid the foundation by adopting the requirement that one-third of our electricity come from renewable sources by that date. This morning, I can tell you we're on track to meet that goal and substantially exceed it. In the last 2 years alone, California has permitted over 16,000 megawatts of solar, wind, and geothermal energy projects. In the beginning of the computer industry, jobs were numbered in the thousands. Now they're in the millions. The same thing will happen with green jobs, and California is positioned perfectly to reap the economic benefits that will inevitably flow. California also leads the nation in cleaning up the air, encouraging electric vehicles, and reducing pollution and greenhouse gases. Our vehicle emission standards, which have always set the pace, now have been adopted by the federal government for the rest of the country. Under AB 32, California has stepped out and crafted a bold plan to deal with climate change and foreign oil dependency. The plan will require less carbon in our fuels, more efficient technologies across a broad swath of businesses, and a carefully designed cap-and-trade system that uses market incentives instead of prescriptive mandates. As a result, California is attracting billions of dollars in clean tech venture capital investments. In 2011, almost 40% of such investments were made in California, making our state not only the leader in the nation, but in the entire world. My commitment is to continue these innovative programs and build on them in the coming year in every way I can. Now, just as bold is our plan to build a high-speed rail system connecting the northern and southern part of our state. This is not a new idea. As governor the last time, I signed legislation to study the concept. Now, 30 years later, we're within weeks of a revised business plan that will enable us to begin initial construction before the year is out. President Obama strongly supports the project and has provided the majority of funds for the first phase. It's now your decision to evaluate the plan and decide what action to take. Without hesitation, I urge your approval. If you believe that California will continue to grow as I do, and that millions more people will be living in our state, this is a wise investment. Building new runways and expanding our airports and highways is the only alternative. That is not cheaper and will face even more political opposition. Those who believe that California is in decline will naturally shrink back from such a strenuous undertaking. I understand that feeling, but I don't share it, because I know this state and the spirit of the people who chose to live here. California is still the gold mountain that Chinese immigrants in 1848 came across the Pacific to find. The wealth is different, derived as it is not from mining the Sierras, but from the creative imagination of those who invent and build and generate the ideas that drive our economy forward. Critics of the high-speed rail project abound, as they often do when something of this magnitude is proposed. During the 1930s, the Central Valley Water Project was called a fantastic dream that will not work. The master plan for the interstate highway system in 1939 was derided as New Deal jitterbug economics. In 1966, then-Mayor Johnson of Berkeley called BART a billion-dollar potential fiasco. Similarly, the Panama Canal was for years thought to be impractical. And Benjamin Disraeli himself said of the Suez Canal, totally impossible. Well, the critics were wrong then, and they're wrong now. And we're going to build the first phase so that in of itself is worth the $2 billion of state money that we're going to invest. Nothing else happened, and it will. Another issue we must tackle is water. Last week, Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar met here in Sacramento with those in my administration who are working to complete the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. Together, we agreed that by this summer, we should have the basic elements of the project we need to build. This is something my father worked on, and that I worked on as well, decades ago. We know more now and are committed to the dual goals of restoring the Delta ecosystem and ensuring a reliable water supply. This is an enormous project. It will ensure water for 25 million Californians and for millions of acres of farmland, as well as 100,000 acres of new habitat for spawning fish and other wildlife. To get it done will require time, political will, and countless permits from state and federal agencies. I invite your collaboration and constructive engagement. Next, I want to say something about our schools. They consume more tax dollars than any other government activity, and rightly so, as they have a profound effect on our future. Since everyone goes to school, everyone thinks they know something about education. And in a sense, they do. But that doesn't stop experts and academics and foundation consultants from offering their ideas, usually labeled reform and regularly changing at 10-year intervals, on how to get kids learning more and better. It's salutary and even edifying that so much interest is shown in the next generation. Nevertheless, in a state with 6 million students, 300,000 teachers, deep economic divisions, and 100 different languages, some humility is called for. In that spirit, in that spirit, I offer these thoughts. First, responsibility must be clearly delineated between the various levels of power that have a stake in our educational system. What most needs to be avoided is concentrating more and more decision-making at the federal or state level. For better or worse, we depend on elected school boards and the principals and teachers they hire. To me, we should set broad goals and have a good accountability system, leaving the real work to those closest to the students. Yes, we should demand continuous improvement in meeting our state standards, but we should not impose excessive or detailed mandates. My budget proposes to replace categorical programs with a new weighted student formula that provides a basic level of funding with additional money for disadvantaged students and those struggling to learn English. This will give more authority to local school districts to fashion the kind of programs they see their students need. It will also create transparency, reduce bureaucracy, and simplify complex funding streams. Given the cutbacks to education in recent years, it's imperative that California devote more tax dollars to this most basic of public services. If we're successful in passing the temporary taxes that I've proposed and the economy continues to expand, schools will be in a much stronger position. No system, however, works without accountability. In California, we have detailed state standards and lots of tests. Unfortunately, the resulting data is not provided until after the school is over. Even today, as I speak to you, the ranking of schools based on tests taken in April and May of 2011 is not available. I believe it's time to reduce the number of tests and get the results to teachers, principals, and superintendents in weeks, not months. With timely data, principals and superintendents can better mentor and guide teachers as well as make sound evaluations of their performance. I believe we also need a qualitative system of assessments, such as a site visitation program where each classroom is visited, observed, and evaluated. I will work with the State Board of Education to develop this proposal. The House of Education is divided by powerful forces and strong emotions. My role as governor is not to choose sides, but to listen, to engage, and to lead. I'll do that. I embrace both reform and tradition, but not complacency. My hunch is that principals and teachers know the most, but I'll take good ideas from wherever they come. As for pensions, I put forth my 12-point proposal. Examine it, improve it, but please, take up the issue and do something real. I'm committed to pension reform because I believe there's a real problem. Three times as many people are retiring as are entering the workforce. This arithmetic doesn't add up. In addition, benefits, contributions, and the age of retirement all have to balance. I don't believe they do today. Start tomorrow. You work for 30 years. Are you going to live to 80, 90, 110? How much is that? How many people are retired? How many people are working? How many people are coming along? How does it all work out? Anybody tells me that you feel absolutely confident that 40 or 50 years from now, things are all going to be paid for, are not looking at the numbers and the other comparable investments. As for prison alignment, we're just at the beginning. The cooperation of sheriffs, police chiefs, probation officers, district attorneys, and local officials have been remarkable. But we have much to do to protect public safety and reduce recidivism, and together we'll get it done. It's one thing to pass a law, and it's quite another to implement and make it work. As I see it, that's my job as governor and as chief executive. Make the operations of government work efficiently, honestly, in the people's interest. With your help, that's what we'll do in 2012 and prove once again that the declinists about California are wrong. We're on the move. We're on the mend. Let's get it done. Thank you.
I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We've just heard Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State address, and we're now going to take the rest of the hour to open the lines for questions and responses from you. Are there budget cuts that will affect your life the most? And what do you think Jerry Brown should be prioritizing? What's your reaction to that speech? And what do you hope for California in 2012? If you work in the green energy industry or in the prison system or the education system, health, please give us a call and let us know how these budget cuts might affect you. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Again, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about Governor Brown's State of the State speech and his proposal for tax increases and budget cuts. We want to know how these cuts would affect you specifically. Give us a call at 866-798-8255. Talk. That's 866-798-8255. And we're joined by Dan Walters, who's a columnist with the Sacramento Bee and an expert on California politics. Walters joined the Sacramento Union's Capitol Bureau in 1975 as Jerry Brown began his first governorship. In 1986, Walters published The New California Facing the 21st Century. He's also the founding editor of the California Political Almanac and co-author of The Third House, Lobbyists, Money, and Power in Sacramento. He's joining us by phone from Sacramento. Hi, Dan.
Hello again.
Hello again. So did anything surprise you in that speech?
No. Most of that stuff had been in the budget previously published in some form. His support for the bullet train was already on record. What he wanted to do in water was already on record. He was basically reiterating. It was more kind of a pep talk, if anything. It was kind of like, you know, we're up, we're coming back, we're on the mend, California is not dying, come along with me, we'll go on the ride, and so on and so forth. So, no, I would say there were no surprises whatsoever in that speech.
He says we're on the move and on the mend. It was a pretty rosy picture of what's happening in the state. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, it's accurate as far as it goes. But as he kind of said, he did say we have some problems. Well, yes, we do have some problems, beginning, of course, with the unbalanced budget and with some real problems in education and transportation, water certainly, and he alluded to all of those. But it was something like, you know, we're on the mend. If you just do what I want you to do, everything will be hunky dory. And that was kind of the Cliff Notes version of what he said. But it's going to be tough for some of these things. Water is always controversial. It's very difficult to get water. The high-speed rail thing has become more controversial. There's a lot of resistance now in the legislature to giving the high-speed rail project more money. He's got some heavy lifting. Plus, of course, as we mentioned earlier, trying to persuade voters to raise taxes, because if they don't do that, then kind of all bets are off. Then we're in this kind of deep hole and no way to climb out, no ready way to climb out.
And before we went to the speech, we had started to talk about the cuts to education and what that's going to mean for schools. He spent a good portion of his speech talking about that. What does this mean for California schools? You started to tell us before the break.
Well, school spending, we're not high in school spending. We're low. And by some counts, lowest in the country. By other counts, not quite so low. It all kind of depends on what you count and what you don't count, of course. If you put all the money in the basket, federal funds, state funds, local funds, construction funds, the whole thing, we're somewhere in the general middle of school spending. If you just concentrate on classroom stuff, we're down towards the bottom. Unfortunately, and he applied this, that the argument over education in California kind of begins and ends with money, and it doesn't ever get to these other factors. He's proposing a fairly significant change in the way we finance schools. More money if the voters approve taxes, but in the absence of that, or even if that occurs, He wants to reconfigure school financing. Instead of trying to equalize school financing pupil by pupil, he wants essentially to give more money to schools to deal with kids that are doing poorly in school or come from poverty and so forth. It's a reweighting. This has been kicking around the legislature for the last couple of years, but it faces enormous difficulty. The first thing, when anybody ever proposes a new way to finance schools, the first thing somebody does is run a spreadsheet that shows district by district who wins and who loses. And, of course, the losers don't like to lose, and so they go in there and try to block anything from happening. So it's a very difficult thing to do, is to change school finance policy in California. And it's a worthy effort. It's probably something that needs to be done, but it's heavy lifting. The other thing, a couple of other things in education, he proposes to reduce and almost eliminate all these so-called categorical aids, which are specialized financing for specialized thing, to give local government, local school districts more flexibility in how they spend the money. And he also wants to reduce the amount of testing that goes on in the classroom, saying it's just taking time away from instruction. It's confusing to everybody, and implicitly encourages teachers to teach to the test rather than trying to teach what students really need to learn. So these are all very worthy sorts of things that have kicked around the Capitol for a long time. But the fact that they have kicked around for a long time and never actually been adopted testifies to how difficult it is to move this this enormous ship of education that has so many captains and so many crewmen and so many people trying to steer it this way and that way and this way and that way. It's an enormously difficult thing. And so, you know, you can't get your hopes up too high that something serious is going to happen on that front.
There was an interesting jab at foundations, education foundations, and the sort of 10-year cycle of reform that changes. And then he said some humility is called for.
Yeah, well, we should be humble about schools. The school system in California is in crisis. By those test results that he doesn't seem to like very much, we're down there sort of near the bottom in basic academic achievement in California. And, you know, to give the schools their due, it's not always the school's fault that this is great. There is the money issue, of course. Secondly, we have an enormously diverse student population. As the governor mentioned, over 100, he said 100 languages, actually well over 100 languages spoken in the schools. Kids coming all sorts of ethnic and linguistic and economic backgrounds. It's a difficult melange of students to try to educate, and of course to educate them for jobs in an economy that's also undergoing a tremendous amount of change. So it's I was kind of struck though by one thing. He wants the test results to get to the teachers and the principals quicker so they can act on them, and yet he has defunded the computerized student tracking system that was supposed to provide that sort of information, which is kind of interesting. But education is this enormous monster. I mean, it's just so difficult. 6 million kids and $60 billion a year, and everybody's got a piece of that pie, and nobody wants to give it up. The teachers don't want to give it up. The counselors don't want to give it up. These people don't want to. You know, it's just an incredibly it's a quicksand. It's a jungle, a sort of Everglades with quicksand that you just can slog on through, and people just get tired of doing it. The education code is like 15 feet wide, all the books put together, and nobody knows what's in it, and it's a mess. But
and
trying to do something about it is very difficult.
It's also, yeah, a challenge. We got an update on the governor's proposed budget from Carlos Garcia, who's the superintendent of San Francisco Unified, and he says SFUSD joined the California School Boards Association and several other districts last year in suing the state in order to get the funding due to education under Prop 98. He goes on to say the budget does not include a cost of living adjustment, which means a hit of over $8 million a year. Year for SFUSD. SFUSD has already made deep cuts, including the following: eliminating 4 days from this school year and last school year, eliminating summer school except for remedial programs required for high school graduation, reducing transportation services by over 40%, reducing central office administration by over 10%. And while the governor's proposed budget doesn't look good, the outlook is even worse if the governor's proposed tax increase does not pass in November. And we've just heard Governor Jerry Brown's State of the State address. We're taking the rest of the hour to open lines for questions and responses. And we really want to hear, are there budget cuts that will affect you and your life the most? What do you think Jerry Brown should be prioritizing? And how would you raise revenue for the state? You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That number again is 866-798-8255. And let's go to Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to your call.
Hello. I was really pleased to hear the governor put energy into the high-speed rail discussion. I've ridden on trains like this in Europe, and they're really quite extraordinary. And no one who's not ridden on them before would understand. They move it up. The ones I was on moved it up to 130 kilometers an hour quietly. They were relatively inexpensive. They left air travel in the dust for mid-distance travel. And I think it's amazing the United States doesn't really have any of these systems yet. I was also pleased that that the RDA question seems really settled. Most people don't understand that the funding that went to the redevelopment agencies was routed out of the state funding that was otherwise going to the school system. So that was absolutely necessary.
So you agree in the abolition of redevelopment departments. You think that that's a good move?
It was critical. There was no way to get control of the state budget because the state was replacing the money that was being diverted from the school funding to the RDAs, and the state had to replace those funds, and it simply didn't have the money, and that was a major reason for these huge deficits we'd been running. So we may be able to start up RDAs again in the future, but for the time being, it was really necessary to extinguish them.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Kevin. And we're going to be taking more calls. We've got a full bank of callers. You can join our discussion at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And specifically, if you work in the green energy industry or the prison system or the education system, we'd like to hear from you. What are your specific reflections on both this speech and the proposed budget cuts, and how would they affect you? 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And next on the line is Brian in San Francisco. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I'm a blogger for I write politics.com, and I thought the speech was sort of what was to be expected.
Mm-hmm.
I think what struck me was the sort of the veracity that Governor Brown really came out with on high-speed rail, which he spent a fair amount of time on and was very forceful with his language in defending the project, which has been in a lot of, you know, trouble recently.
And you write for Calitics.com?
Right, yes.
So we'll put a link to that at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. Tell me more about your reactions to this speech and what you think of the budget cuts also. Who's going to be affected by this, and what is rational and what is too painful?
Well, you know, from a progressive standpoint, I don't think there's really a good budget that's possible given the legislative trauma that goes on in Sacramento. With the two-thirds votes required for revenue, I just don't think that there's a budget that can really be passed in Sacramento that can really help us. The revenue measures in November are extremely important, whether it be Brown's or another millionaire tax, which is going around as well.
And let's talk a little bit about solutions, both with you, Brian, and Dan. The group California Tax Reform lays out a number of revenue streams that would raise $20 billion, including eliminating corporate tax loopholes, taxing untaxed windfalls, ending tax breaks with no benefits, and maintaining the vehicle license fee. What are some of the solutions that you think should be on the table? Let's go first to Brian and then to Dan.
Well, I mean, at this point, considering what we've been through for the last, you know, five or six budget cycles, I don't think there really should be any option that's really off the table, per se. The VLF, I think we've seen almost immediately when Arnold Schwarzenegger came in that it was a mistake to cut it again. You know, that $6 billion a year would have filled in on a continuing basis what has been much of the structural budget deficit. over the last few years.
Yeah, that really sent the state into a spiral.
Absolutely.
So what other solutions do you think should be on the table?
Well, you know, I mean, there's the oil extraction tax, which was raised in Los Angeles and was defeated in Los Angeles, primarily because the oil companies argued that, you know, we can't do a single city option. But, you know, I grew up in Texas, and I went to the University of Texas, where oil extraction helped pay for my education. And I think it's imperative that we, you know, stop pretending that, you know, California should be different from, you know, other states. You know, Texas and Alaska have, you know, subsidized their state government based on oil extraction fees. And there's, you know, a number of other revenues which, because of the way our lobbying structure has been so overdeveloped in the last few years, the corporate lobbyists, you know, continue to kill them and kill them and kill them. But, you know, at some point, you know, we need to, you know, look at all these revenue options.
And Dan Walters, what are some of the solutions that you think we should be discussing?
Well, I think we should talk about reforming taxes to make it less volatile, to make it more dependable, more predictable. We have increasing levels of volatility. In fact, the governor's, as I mentioned earlier, the governor's plan would increase this volatility, would make it more difficult to forecast future revenues. And since the spending side of the ledger is so fixed, it creates this ongoing budget crisis. I would, frankly, if I would want to increase revenues, I would widen the basis of the sales and the income taxes and reduce the rates. I think you have better long-term revenue growth potential there. I would close loopholes. There's $60 billion a year in state tax loopholes. Some of them are never going to be closed. For example, the sales tax exemption on food and drugs, or the mortgage interest rate deduction. But there are a lot of them that are just absolutely ridiculous. And you could pick up billions of dollars by closing some of these unjustified loopholes. The governor is not proposing tax reform. He said what he's proposing is not tax reform. He says that's what we ought to do someday. But in effect, he's proposing unreform, because his proposal, while raising revenues, would also skew the tax system even further in what I consider to be a very dangerous direction. And so someday we've got to fix that tax system and make it more predictable, more stable, and get rid of this boom and bust cycle that has been so corrosive in state politics, particularly for the last 10 years, but even really for the last 30 or 30-plus years.
And that's Dan Walters. He's a political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and I want to get to some more callers here. Thanks so much, Brian, and let's go to Roy in Carmel. Hi, Roy.
Yes, you were looking for how the state can legitimately increase its income, and I think there's a huge subsidy on agricultural water, and some of the corporate farms in the southern San Joaquin Valley are selling, quote, their agricultural water, but our Constitution says all the water in the state belongs to the people, all the water that flows on the rivers or in canals, and we've spent billions and billions of dollars subsidizing water for big farms, and they're selling the water for billions of dollars to developers in San Diego. The biggest expense for electricity for the state is to pump water. The farmers should be paying their fair share. They should, more than what it costs, they should pay for the overhead for all the agencies and all the trouble fooling with them. So the farming industry is going great. The people are subsidizing it, and I think that's not right.
Thanks so much, Roy. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Welcome to your call, Harry.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to comment quickly about the high-speed rail. I think that, you know, comparing it to Europe is not the same as comparing it to here. And so far, it's a huge boondoggle in terms of where they're constructing it, how much it's going to cost. And already, it costs a fortune to go from San Francisco to San Jose by rail, and the service isn't very good. I would say put the money into bus services, improving bus services, and putting, improving the train service between towns and making it more affordable. They spend a lot of money on ridiculous things like the Clipper card when they could be spending that money to subsidize fares. They should be subsidized. They're way too high, from the $2 Muni fare to the BART fares. They all need to come down. And Governor Brown is not going to do anything about really taxing the wealthy, because that's the constituency he comes from. And I haven't found him to be genuine about anything. And I have no expectations whatsoever that, you know, he's going to be a success, because he's not really able to institute the tax policy because of the reasons we've been dealt with Proposition 13.
Thank you so much, Harry. We really appreciate it. And we've only got a minute left here, Dan. I just wanted to get some final thoughts from you on this budget, the tax proposal, and solving this crisis.
As I said before, this is a roll of the dice. At this moment, nobody can say whether the voters will buy into this tax increase or not. For one thing, we don't know how many tax increases will be on the ballot. The more they're on the ballot, probably the less likely it is that it's going to pass, because people get confused. And he's gotten one off the ballot, but there's still a couple of others kicking around there. If he's all by himself, he's got a pretty good chance. If he's got other tax measures competing, then his chances go down. He knows that. He's trying to get off. But remember, this tax proposal will not solve California's budget problems. First of all, it makes the tax volatility worse. And secondly, it's temporary. And until the state economy recovers, this is just going to be a patch on the situation. It's not going to be a real solution.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Dan Walters. He's a columnist with the Sacramento Bee and an expert on California politics, which he's been covering since 1975. And we're going to have to leave it there. I want to tell you what's coming up tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll have a conversation about how the rhetoric and reality of politics around reproductive rights has changed since Roe v. Wade. Tomorrow is the 39th anniversary of the historic decision. But today's political scene is becoming more and more vitriolic over abortion. So who's fighting back and how? And what happened to the women's movement of the 70s and the advances gained in women's right to choose? That'll be tomorrow with Rose Aguilar. Friday, of course, is our media roundtable. And we're going to put web resources at our new website, which is yourcallradio.org. We're also podcasting our show, and you can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter. I want to give a special thanks to Mark Jones and Capital Public Radio in Sacramento for providing us with the live feed of Governor Brown's State of the State address today. And thank you all for joining us. Thank you for your calls and emails, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How have politics around reproductive rights changed since Roe v. Wade? On the Next Your Call, we'll talk about the status of women's reproductive rights 39 years after the Roe decision legalized abortion. Today's political rhetoric is becoming more vitriolic over abortion. Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. From personhood amendments to the closure of women's clinics, what's happening at the state level across the country? Who's fighting back and how? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.